Hello and welcome to the very first episode of the Prodigy podcast. My name is Hassan and what we're going to be doing is interviewing the very best upcoming athletes in BJJ and MMA. I am excited. What we're going to be doing is talking to them to find out a bit about who they are, you know, what makes them tick, what has come together to form this person who wants to be the best athlete they can be. And is just performing at a really high level. So we're going to be talking to them just to really delve down into who they are and hopefully not only find out about who they are, but hopefully you'll be able to take away some insights from them, whether that's about how they train, what mindset they use when they compete and all manner of other things. So without further ado, my very first guest is Ben Robson. Ben is a brown belt at CF24 Cardiff. As well as this, he runs one half of Unorthodox Nutrition and Performance with Mike Leng. So we talk about that. And he is really quite open and honest about how he trains and how he struggles with some things and doesn't with others. So it was just a really insightful interview into what kind of person Ben is, and hopefully you'll be able to take away something with it too. So without further ado, settle down, grab a coffee, and listen to the very first episode with Ben Robson.
Cool. So we're going to start.
Yeah, let's get rolling.
Spud. Yes. What else we have? When you Google Ben Robson, Instagram Ben Robson, I found like a million nicknames and I didn't know which one to look for. Yeah. So can you explain El Diablo? Where have these all come from?
So the original nickname's El Diablo, and that started in my old club when I started training jiu-jitsu. So there's a guy in roll with, and he was like, oh, you're a devil to roll with. And he was like, you're El Diablo. And it just kind of stuck, and everyone started calling me Diablo, and it just kind of stuck from there. And yeah, there's a guy, Martin Ashton, who used to run sub 15 back in the day, like one of the original UK sub onlys. And to this day, I don't think he knows that my middle name's not El Diablo. but yeah, and then Spud came from just in the gym. It was kind of like a gym nickname. It was like not the most aesthetically pleasing features of a man is my face, so it's like a bit of a spud, and everyone started calling that and saying I had like a spud head. So kind of in the gym, known like hard to get like guillotined and choked, and head and arms probably like one of those positions I like where people think they can tap me and they'll struggle a little bit. And I was like, oh, you've got a spud head. And then it just got nicknamed like spud and it just kept sticking.
So it's more the thing that people just annoyed they couldn't sub you.
Yeah, pretty much. And just like nicknames have stemmed from that. And yeah, the spud kind of started. And yeah, and like my girlfriend Leah, her surname's Bud, so it was like Spud and Bud, and it kind of stuck from that.
Hey, it's the TV show writes itself.
Yeah, I know. Need some Spud and Bud jiu-jitsu documentary or something.
Brilliant. So you've been training for 7 years. Where does it was that your first sport? Was BJJ your first sport?
No, so I started like most lads from West Wales started with rugby or football. So it was like, where I was from, you did like a bit of football, a bit of rugby. So mainly from a rugby background is where I started. And then I kind of fell out of love with rugby. And I thought, oh, I need to try something else. I was watching UFC. And I actually did gymnastics for about 9 months and just went and did gymnastics class. And then from there, I was like, oh, actually, no, I'm not built for this. I want to do something a bit more aggressive. And found like a small MMA club and went there and realized I'm not very good at punching people or getting punched in the head. So I just started doing the jiu-jitsu more and more from there. So that's where it started.
And you still dabbled in the MMA. You did IMMAF. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so it was one of those ones where I did jiu-jitsu and I kind of, like anyone, you watch UFC, you're like, oh, that's the goal. And I thought, okay, like I've done jiu-jitsu for a bit now. Like, oh, let's just try MMA. I was like, let's see what it's like with striking. And got into MMA and I saw the IMAF trials come up and I was like, oh, okay, let's, if we're going to fight anyone, let's fight the world's best amateurs and just jump in the deep end. Got into the UK team then, which I was surprised about. There was trials and everything. And I was like 2-0 at that point. And I'm pretty sure I just got in because I was a purple belt as well. And jumped in from there and did the Europeans and the Asian Open. So MMA is one of those ones where kind of it's what started me on the path of jiu-jitsu. And it's kind of like had its own little run along the side. And I've always had a love for MMA and enjoyed it, but sort of striking's always been like a weakness, and yeah. I kind of
and you always fell back on the jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, I fell back on the jiu-jitsu, and it's like I've kind of taken a step away from MMA now, like had that good run with the IMAFs and then injured my knee and sort of had a bit of bad luck with injuries and took a step away from MMA. But it's kind of one of those ones where it's like constantly getting messages when you're going back into MMA. And it's something I probably will do, but I think the timing has to be right. But yeah, it's like sort of MMA and jiu-jitsu have kind of run parallel together. It's like they, for me, they've never been two separate paths. They kind of run together. I'm always watching MMA, so it's kind of...
They're always so close anyway.
Yeah, yeah, and I think like through coaching now as well, it's like I'm always... Someone I know has always got an MMA fight and they're like, oh, can you help me with this? Can we do a bit of cage wrestling? So it's like they go hand in hand together so well.
And you, and so you're still practicing it. You're still kind of got at least one hand in it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And like whether that's like sort of doing the sort of shoot boxing with some of the guys down in one of my classes, there's like a lot of MMA guys there and helping them with sort of setting up their shots and their jiu-jitsu with strikes, or rolling with like sort of that combat jiu-jitsu, like slaps and sort of slap someone in the head or rolling. There's like always got a, something in there. So yeah, I've always got like sort of toe in the water, like, so to speak.
What do you think of the combat jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. I think it's, I was looking the other day, I was like, oh, I wonder how you get into that. I saw Ben Eddie put someone to sleep in the Worlds, and I was like, okay, what's this? Like, where'd you go for this? And I thought, that's pretty cool. And I think it's quite good transition for pure jiu-jitsu guys to slowly transition across. Because I think you see some jiu-jitsu guys will just take a leap, and it just doesn't pay off. And you're like, okay, you could have been a bit smarter with it. And
yeah,
I can see why they do, and like some of them, they have to just go and jump in, because like if they're established black belt, how are they gonna get matches? It's like you're not gonna get that many matches as like an amateur, so you have to go straight pro. And if you get a couple losses as a pro by the wrong matchups, then it's kind of not good for your career.
Yeah,
so I think it's a good transition that you could get some people can sort of transition slowly into that and do well in jiu-jitsu, combat jiu-jitsu, and then slowly progress into MMA.
And was that your first experience of traveling internationally to compete?
The IMAFs.
The IMAFs, yeah.
No, I'd done some like international jiu-jitsu competitions. I think once you start competing in jiu-jitsu, it's one of the things like, oh, I can get a holiday and go and compete. So I'd done like the European Nogi and like Paris Open, IBJFs and things like that before then, and did the Rome Open as a blue belt. So I'd traveled a little bit to jiu-jitsu, but that was the first time for me like traveling in a team setting. So it kind of, I have friends in like elite level like hammer throwing and athletics, and they're going, oh, we're going on camp, or we're going to this international competition. They go as a team. It was the first time I'd gone as a team, which was a new experience, but yeah, wasn't the first time I'd competed internationally at all.
What was that atmosphere like as a team to go and compete?
It was quite strange for the two IMAFs. So it's like the first one, the Europeans, it was like you went through the trials and you got selected, and then there was squad sessions. So you, like, I think every couple of weeks we were up in Leicester training with the UK squad. So you got to train with people and you built friendships, and that was quite good. And there was a big team of us, which was quite nice. And then obviously you're in a hotel together, and then afterwards you get to relax and enjoy your experience with each other. But then when I went to Singapore, there was two lads that had been in UK IMAF teams previously, but not the same Europeans I was in. And then I met up with them out in Singapore, first time I met them, and we stayed in separate hotels. I had family out in Singapore, so I stayed with them, and it was like kind of a different dynamic. It was a bit better for me because it kind of brought me back to being in like a jiu-jitsu environment where it's like, it's a tournament, you stay somewhere, you just go to the venue on the day. Whereas the Europeans is very like, the hotel and the venue were one. It was like a big exhibition center with a hotel attached. So it's like,
it's just all that intensity in one time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like constantly, like, if you're not fighting, you're around people who are going to fight. If you're not like fighting or around people who are going to fight, and you're weight cutting, or you're around people weight cutting. So it's like you're always in it. Whereas Singapore was like, I turned up, I had the weigh-ins, I'd go away, I'd look around Marina Bay, I'd come back, and then like the next day I'd fight, or someone, one of the teammates would be fighting, so I'd jump in their corner. So it's quite a bit more relaxed, which kind of suited me from a jiu-jitsu background.
Is that how you treat tournaments as well? So when you go to just any comp, do you try and keep it as relaxed as possible?
Yeah, I try to, but I think for me, it's like if someone went to me, like, what's your competition strategy? I think even as a brown belt who's competed quite a bit, I can't pin down what works well for me, because like the British this year, it's probably the best I've ever felt competing. And then a few weeks later I fought and it was the worst I've ever felt competing. So it's like, I try and keep it as relaxed as possible and not put too much on it. I like John Danaher's approach where he talks about the parable of the plank, where it's kind of like you need to make the tournament like training. And I was trying to make training like a tournament as well. So here in the days we have, we call it like pro training. So it's kind of like not closed door, it's open to anyone, but it's not on our timetable. It's like, if you know about it, you know about it. If you don't, then you're unlucky. But it's
Cardiff's own fight club.
Yeah, like we kind of developed it like with Brennan, like me and Brennan sat down and had a conversation and we were talking about quite cool, like you have with the Cardiff City Football Club, there's like the hooligan, like the sort of scene with that, and it's like the Cardiff City Soul Crew, and we were like, oh, the Cardiff City Roll Crew. And I was like, it's pretty cool with that. So we like kind of got that pro training going, and it's just one of those things, you turn up, no excuses, time goes on and you train really hard. And for me, I tried to make that like my tournament. So we have a thing where we'd stick a 10-minute timer on. And it's like, that's your warm-up time. And either you grab a partner, you drill before we start the sparring. And for me, in the lead-up to the British, I would do the same warm-up as I do on a tournament. And I'd chuck my headphones on. I'd listen to the same playlist and do that, which helped massively. So trying to keep it relaxed and like kind of keep the tournament relaxed, but also making my training similar so it feels normal.
It's like you're psychologically training yourself. You're getting that kind of association, the music, the same warm-up every time you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So it's like kind of trying to program to that, but kind of I still need to hone how to do that in any scenario and not get too tunnel visioned when sort of things you can't control go wrong.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think like sports psychology is something I'm massively trying to work on. It's kind of a definite weak area for mine.
Is that, have you ever worked with anyone?
No, so I kind of for like blue belt and start purple belt, I just go and fight hard. It was just, I just thought if I can outwork someone, great. But then as people get more technical, I was like, okay, it's not working as well. And kind of I focus more on MMA as purple belt, and I was like, I need to get back into competing in jiu-jitsu. And it was kind of like my, I just got nerves that I hadn't had since I was a white belt. And it's something I've been trying to look for, is like working with a sports psychologist. Like I think two people will chat too much stuff online and not accept that they do get nervous, because it's part of the process. You're going to get nervous. And if you don't, then like you probably don't care enough about it. So it's something I haven't done, but I'm constantly looking for. And I'm lucky that through like my PhD that I work with some sports psychologists, so I can kind of like pick their brains about stuff, which is it's kind of helpful.
You've got access to a nice pool of people.
Yeah, kind of like rope them in without having to go and pay their extortionate consultant fees.
So let's go back a bit.
Yep.
The Rome IBJJF.
Yeah.
I know there's a story behind it. It was an experience.
Yeah, so this was this 2016? So it was a while back, but yeah, we'd gone out there. It was when I first started seeing Leah, we'd booked a hotel, we were going away, and we got out there and we like went to our hotel, and it was just absolute dog shit. It was just like, it was horrendous, and it was like one of those ones. So it was like, yeah, we'd had drama as well, getting from the airport to the city centre. We got on a train, didn't realise you need to like stamp your ticket before you get on. Conductor comes around to check your ticket. We hadn't stamped it. We thought he would stamp it. He's like, no, you've got to, here's a fine. If you don't pay the fine, then you get arrested. Like, great. Okay. Go to the hotel. Dreadful. There's signs on the walls. Don't open the door, even if they say it's the police. And we're like, okay, we don't want to stay around here. So we ended up like leaving that. We hadn't paid yet. So we just left that hotel and we're like, right, we'll find somewhere else. Like went to one hotel. No, fully booked. And we found somewhere like miles out of the way. Really nice hotel in the end. And it was kind of one of those things where it was like anything that could go wrong, went wrong, which was kind of like maybe a good thing, because then when it came to compete, it was better. And it was like, I fought in the gi and I don't think I conceded a point in the gi. And it was like, I was like, what's the worst that can happen? So,
exactly.
But yeah, like as a trip, it was horrible, but competitively it was awesome.
Is that something you try and reflect back on to your student?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely tell them like, it's like, don't worry about it. I was like, just focus on yourself. And especially as like a trip like that, where it's like, just enjoy the experience. Like you don't want to look back and think, oh, I've gone to this country and just like moped around all the time. It's just, it is what it is. And I was lucky, I'd just been sponsored by Whiskey Wolf. I like, they just started sponsoring me, and the guy Rich, like, he's become like a really good friend like since he started sponsoring me. And he messaged me and was like wishing me good luck, and I was asking how the trip had gone so far, and I just told him the whole story. And that's where the sort of saying like control the controllable came from. And he just sent that to me, and I was like, oh, he's right. I can't control how bad the hotel was. I can't control that the guy on the train was a bit of an ass and was going to try and fine us. I couldn't control any of that, but I can control how I perform. I was like, I can just go out and fight my hardest. And like that helped massively. And that's something I relate back to my students or try to. And I actually use that like story as an example of like, sometimes like it's all like shit's going to hit the fan. You just got to throw your hands up and be like, okay, it is what it is. Just try and carry on.
Yeah. And that's perfect. I think that's the best way to show to your students that you can still perform even when the day hasn't been great.
Yes, I use that as an example. Like everything can go wrong and you can still perform well. I tell them about like competitions where I've gone in and I've like felt great and I've done terrible, where I've gone in, felt terrible and done terrible. And I've like told them about times where I've gone to some tournaments and I've really not wanted to compete. I think I was cutting weight for a MMA fight and I was like, okay, I'll do a jiu-jitsu tournament just as like a warm-up, just get used to the adrenaline. And I think I'd like sparred like MMA a couple of days before, and then the tournament day came and like alarm goes off and like Leah's waking up. She's like, come on, we've got to go, like it's time to, we've got to like hit the road early to get to the thing. And I was like, I really don't want to go. I got in the car, I fell asleep straight away, turned up, I was so depleted and I was like, I don't want to do this. Like I just didn't want to fight. I didn't do a warm-up, sat there. And they were like, Ben, time to fight. And I just like sat up and was like, okay. And I went in and tapped everyone. And I was like, okay. Like, so sometimes you can feel terrible and do well. And I was like, I think that's probably why I've had such a mixed bag with the tournaments I've done, that when I talk about like sports psychology, I'm like, I still haven't figured it out. Like, and I think you just have to make of it what it is, embrace the process, try and control the controllable and just sort of go out and do your best. Like just go and like sort of try and showcase your ability as best you can, rather than focusing too much on outside, like external factors.
Yeah. And do you think your game has changed for belt to belt? What was the major difference for you from purple to brown belt? And sort of how did the things change?
I think the best way to do it is like, if I look at myself, probably start with blue belt. Like when I first got my blue belt, I was like a guard player out and out, and I'd either try and triangle someone, inverted triangle them as they pass my guard, or they pass my guard and beat me, and that was it. And then started training with Omid, one of the coaches at CF24, and he was there and he sort of like, right, okay, you need to work on this. And I came to Cardiff for university, got on with Bryn, very very good guard passer, and he was like, okay, we're working on guard passing. And then I started like flip my game and I was like, right, okay, I'm a top player, and I started playing that. And then I got to purple belt and I was like, I'm still a top player. And I switched to MMA and it was like, okay, now I've got that MMA style like explosive rounds like sort of rolling. And then now it's like kind of changed where I feel good in both scenarios. So I feel good top and bottom, but I think for me more, it's not so much like, oh, here's my game X, Y, and Z, like I'm a top player, I pass with these guard passes, or I'm a guard player. But it's more understanding the gray. And it's like kind of like, I try and articulate this to my students when I teach, is like, it's not so much understanding the black and white. So anyone can show you a position and here's black and white, like you do this, you put this here and you get X result. But it's understanding sort of the gray, so the feeling of it. So it's kind of getting that proprioception in a position and understanding that in more depth. And like you're probably noticing more when you roll, is like you feel tension and you feel that like push pull, and understanding what's good about that, what's bad about it, like where you can go with that. And I think that's the biggest difference at brown belt, is understanding that sort of, the gray is the best way to do it. It's like understanding the gray is what is the biggest difference now. And I had this conversation with Omi the other day and we were talking about like how I feel, like he said to me, he's like, Ben, you feel good in every position, but now it's like the understanding of like that gray is what matters now. And it's like the sort of strength in depth. So it's not so much having the breadth of a game, but it's having depth in those areas now and understanding everything. So I think that's the biggest transition, which is like, it's maybe not my game that's changed from belt to belt, but it's sort of the understanding of it all.
Yeah. Your general understanding of BJJ rather than, and all different variations of positions rather than set techniques and things like that.
Yeah. And I think like more as well, like understanding the inches of it. So it's like, I've probably fell in love with jiu-jitsu more since getting my brown belt like a few months ago than ever before. And that's because like, I'm figuring out like the smallest transitions, like literally like a small gripping variation, and then it'll like pay off. And it's like working little tactics like that, and sort of trying to just spar so specifically and figuring out those little inches and seeing where that leads in this like sort of that that game of chess, like it's like old cliche, and it's like kind of is that little understanding those inches is what is like more exciting now than sort of any other belt. And I guess like I probably would never have comprehended it at a lower belt, but I think you needed to progress through the belts and to get to that level. So yeah, that's probably the biggest difference for me.
If we're gonna talk about your PhD and going back, when did you start doing performance, looking at sports science?
So yeah, so I probably started like most people, like when I was like 15, like start going to the gym, you get like pick up like a fitness magazine, like most teenage boys are like, okay, I want to start looking good. And I started getting into the fitness side of that, and I was like, I just wanted to understand it more and sort of progress through like doing the standard, like doing your GCSEs, A levels, like PE, and understanding the theory side of PE. Mm-hmm. And then came to Cardiff to do my undergrad in sports science. When is that? That was probably 2014, 2015. And yeah, started with undergrad in sports science and sort of enjoyed that and progressed through that. And then was like competing more and understanding like the principles that I learned through uni, I could apply to my own training. And then helping a few other people, I helped my friends out and my brother with their training, and sort of understanding, we're like, okay, if I put these principles into practice, I can see performance benefits. That progressed then, and I kind of finished my undergrad and was doing a bit of MMA and jiu-jitsu. I was like, I don't really know what I want to do. And I picked up a book by Steve Ingham, who's like a quite a well-known sports scientist. And it was like How to Support a Champion. And it's about his sort of journey as a sports scientist. He's a physiologist by trade. And I picked that up and I was like, this is really interesting. I want to know more about this like elite sports setting. Mm-hmm. And that's made me like, was the inspiration for me to want to go and do my master's. Then I went and did my master's in sports science, and I've just finished that. So I've just finished that while starting my PhD. But yeah, I started that, and kind of, I've always had a love for biomechanics and human movement, rather than sort of like the biochemistry side of it and like the physiology side of things. So I went down the specific pathway in Cardiff Met. We've got like, you can do sports science masters, but you can also sort of become tunnel vision and bottleneck your studies. So I kind of bottlenecked, and there was me and one other lad who did biomechanics specifically. So I didn't do any physiology or sports psychology modules. It was just biomechanics. And I injured my knee then as well, at the start of my masters.
Oh, so I, like, so you threw yourself into it.
Yeah, kind of like threw myself in. And it was kind of funny that I did, like, I tore my MCL, and we were doing a sports injury biomechanics module at the time. So I was kind of just like the case study for everyone. When we had the practicals, I was the case study. And yeah, I went down that route, did that, and then did obviously like performance side, like biomechanics of it, and progressed then through my master's, and did I finished off Erasmus term in Rome. So I did my data collection for my master's thesis out there. So that was focusing on like the pre-activation of the sort of musculature around the knee in people who had a reconstructed ACL. Okay. So it was like, that was in a step descent as well. So we specifically looked at the step descent. So it's more like an applied setting. So it's like a lot of people, when they've sort of had their ACL reconstructed, they struggle with sort of day-to-day activities like climbing stairs, walking downstairs, yeah, stepping off a pavement. So it's kind of understanding that in more detail. Focused on that, came back from Rome, finished off my master's, and I was like, we'll come into the end of it. And I was like, I don't know if I want to go full-time jiu-jitsu or apply for a PhD. I'd been in Rome for just over 3 months and thought, okay, I want to be in Cardiff. I love Cardiff City. I think if there's a PhD comes up in Cardiff, I'll apply for it. If not, then I'll just do jiu-jitsu. And the PhD in Cardiff came up, I applied and I got it. So now I'm studying that, and it's the subsequent injury risk following concussion. Specifically in rugby players. So I get funding from the Welsh Rugby Union. So working with two regional teams now to look at sort of the injury risk factors following concussion. So it's sort of well known that people, after they've had a concussion, sort of they have balance deficits, cognitive function deficits, as well as being sort of having like sort of post-concussive symptoms. But when they return to sport, even if they're asymptomatic, they're still at like balance deficits. So it's trying to understand that more, and whether we can inform their sort of graduated return to play a bit better and sort of reduce the risk of them having a further injury. So a few studies have shown that players who've been concussed, they will have a subsequent injury sooner than people who'd had a time loss injury. So if you blew out your knee and I was concussed, I would get my following injury a lot quicker than you would get your following injury. So it's kind of like, can we understand these deficits a bit better and try and sort of, it's kind of inevitable that they're going to get injured in an elite sport. They're kind of waiting for an injury to happen, but can we reduce these numbers of injuries and understand it a bit better?
And it's something that's coming up more often now, especially in MMA, people getting knocked out or having head injuries and kind of considering actually how much time it takes, whether that's for training or competing.
Yeah, so if, like, this is kind of like my researcher's hat is like always on, and I'm always thinking about stuff like, how could I apply this to jiu-jitsu or MMA? Mm-hmm. It's interesting doing it in rugby, but obviously my passion is jiu-jitsu and rugby, jiu-jitsu and MMA. And yeah, I was thinking the same is like in rugby, when they have their graduate return to play, it's not the best. In my opinion, it's probably could do with being flipped on its head and actually they need to rethink it. Mm-hmm. But they don't do any training. So it's like what the team says in elite sport anyway, it's like they come in, they have to do all these like rehab stuff and that's all they do. Whereas MMA, especially like the lower levels, it's like they could go into gym and still spar. So it's like you might not, like the guys in the UFC, they could get knocked out and be like, okay, you're medically suspended, you're not going to fight for, I think it's like 60 days. But there's nothing to say they can't walk into the gym, stick gloves on a spar.
Yeah.
And it's like they could be banned for 60 days, but they could take a bit of time off, recover, sort of in inverted commas, like just recover and...
Put a gum shield in and stuff.
Yeah, and start sparring again, and they get like secondary concussion symptoms then, and then they keep it going, and these like symptoms are like prolonged. And then when it comes around for them to fight again, like they haven't recovered from that first concussion, they've just kept getting hit in the head. And it's like how many times you see people in like the UFC, they'll get like knocked out, and like they're like, oh, I thought they had an iron jaw, and then like next thing you know, they've got glass jaw. And it's kind of like, you see it all the time, and it's like, I think there needs to just be better education for sports like that.
It's kind of these bro terms when really there's something behind it and it's the way they're training.
Yeah, and I can see it as well. It's like the mentality, like anyone's MMA is very alpha and they're like, no, I feel fine. And like, obviously if you feel fine, you're going to think you can train. And it's the same with the rugby players. They're like, I feel fine. Why can't I return to play? And it's like, oh, actually, you look at your balance deficit, like your like postural control is all over the place. And it's like these little things that you can't test unless you have sort of something to test it with. Mm-hmm. And if you feel fine, then you're going to want to train. It's like it's your passion. It's like they're so passionate about it that they're just like, no, I'm okay, I'll just carry on. Or they think like that, yeah, that bro thing where it's like, no, I'll just shrug it off and carry on. And it's like, I think it's a little bit more education needs to be needed. And probably one of the reasons why I'm a bit hesitant with returning to MMA is because
you're now equipped with all this knowledge.
I know it. And it's like, I always like say it to the guys, like, is the juice worth the squeeze? And I kind of, for me, even though I'm researching, I probably will return to it. But if something happens, like if I do get a concussion or like if I get sort of knocked out, then it's like, okay, I need to take adequate steps to properly recover from this. And it's becoming more and more prevalent with like sort of more and more cases of CTE. And MMA's not been around long enough to see sort of this happening. There's going to be symptoms of it, but we just need someone like, you can't really tell the extent of it until they die and you cut open their brain. It's like
An MMA athlete who passed away. I can't remember the UFC fighter now, and they were saying that he had CTE.
Yeah.
Post-mortem, they identified that he had CTE.
Yeah. So I think it's like there's a couple of different proteins in the brain that will sort of identify CTE, and you don't fully know the sort of levels of this until after they've passed away. So. But yeah, I think I just need a bit more education in sports like that.
Okay, I'll throw a light-hearted question in there because obviously you have all this knowledge, you help people with their strength and conditioning, things like that.
Yep.
What's the stupidest SNC question you've been asked? There must be one.
Yeah, no, I think it's probably like a term. It's not like the stupidest question, but they're like, well, like, can you help me out? I want to like cut weight and get really strong, or like it's kind of one of those classic ones, like, I want to build muscle and lose fat. And it's, I think people just need to understand how this works. It's hard for people to like get that in their head that it's actually quite hard to do that. And it's hard to say like a very specific one. It's just like uneducated, not so much questions but statements towards me. People don't really ask like intelligent questions. Yeah. Like, or,
they just want answers.
Yeah, and a lot of people just want like to tell it. Like, they want to come to you and be like, oh yeah, can you tell me I can eat whatever I want and I'll still lose weight? And it's like, to an extent, because it is just calories in, calories out, but there's more to it than that. And I wouldn't be able to have like an online business if I didn't understand that enough. But yeah, a lot of people just can't even get that in, that they need to stop eating shit.
People need to start eating more vegetables.
Yeah, like the best term, I think, is Mike Lang said it, and he just says, like, stop eating like a child. And he's like, when you stop eating, like, just cereal all the time and you actually learn to, like, just cook some food and realize you've got to eat some vegetables, then it becomes quite easy. So it's like, just stop eating like a child is probably the easiest one.
So let's talk about Mike and the Unorthodox brand now. When did you start Unorthodox Performance?
So that was me being glutton for punishment and always taking on more.
I know, you do like to keep busy by the looks of it.
Yeah. So Unorthodox Performance started just when I started my master's. I'd worked with Mike as a client, and he knew I was doing my undergrad in sports science, and he knew that I'd had an interest in nutrition, and he contacted me and was like, oh, we need to meet up, we need to have a chat. And I was like, oh, what's this going to be about? And I caught a train up to Manchester, and he came down from Middlesbrough. And we started chatting, and he said that he wanted to expand Unorthodox, and he wanted to sort of open up a route for people to have S&C plans, but more for like jiu-jitsu athletes, because we sort of noticed there was a bit of a gap in the market. Nobody was doing it effectively. And so we had a lot of PTs and S&C coaches who worked with jiu-jitsu athletes, but nobody was tapping into the online market that well. So we start from there. So Mike kind of helped me out with that and was like, okay, I'll help you. I'll sort of mentor you with the nutrition side of it, and you can run the S&C side of it. And we sort of built it up from that and got things working from there. And now it's, like we kind of have the brand, like Mike's labeled it like Unorthodox Incorporated. So he heads up Unorthodox Nutrition. I run Unorthodox Performance. But a lot of people get confused because they see me working with people and doing their nutrition, but I'm not an orthodox nutrition. But yeah, a lot of that's come from Mike helping me with that, and he sort of gave me a lot of knowledge and mentoring with that, and helped me with like all the stuff you don't see, that like everyone thinks is cool. Oh yeah, like understanding how nutrition plans work, but it's like the business side of things as well, like how to create a website, how to market things, how to do the social media. Like Mike's kind of the same as me, glutton for punishment. He's got Unorthodox Performance, runs a marketing business like really well. So he works and helps out Polaris and Tatami with their marketing. He does all that. So he helped me out massively with that side of things. The kind of the stuff you don't see that goes behind a business. Everyone sees like, oh yeah, you got to be self-employed and do all this stuff yourself. But all the like
grunt,
yeah, the grunt work that goes behind it. Mike's been a massive help with all that stuff.
And you say you're a glutton for punishment. Do you think you've always had that mindset?
I was probably a bit of a lazy teenager, but I think that's just like anyone as you go. I was a bit of a lazy teenager. But it was one of the things that my dad always told me, was just like, just work harder. He's like, I don't care if you like do well in school. He's like, I don't care if you're smart, as long as you're working hard. And he's like, you can always work harder. And his like thing was like, be the hardest worker in any room. And like being a twin, it was kind of like, if I'm outworking my brother, then I'm doing okay. And it's like, just keep trying to outwork like anyone in a room. And then Mike was the same then as well. Like Mike, when I spoke to Mike, and he was like, oh yeah, be the hardest worker in any room. He's like, unless I'm in the room. So that kind of rivalry. And I think it's just like through being competitive, I've sort of built that up over the years. It's hard to say whether like I've always been like that. Like I think I was just like a lazy teenager, and kind of like, if I work hard I can get results, rather than being talented. I've never been super talented. It's kind of just had to put in that graft and learn, I guess, earlier than most people, like how to just put in that grunt work.
Well, I mean, by the looks of the amount you've competed, I've noted down a few highlights. So 2017, and obviously all the IMMAF stuff. 2018, you fought Jay Butler on Polaris.
Yeah.
How was fighting on Polaris?
That was cool. When I got the message for that, I was still out in Rome for my Erasmus term, and I was supposed to stay out there until Christmas. Mm-hmm. So I came back pretty much a whole month earlier, just to fight on Polaris, because they were kind of like, they didn't even said who I was fighting. They were like, do you want to fight on it? And I was just like, yep, book my flight time now.
And was that your first big invitational?
That's probably the biggest one I've done. I've done other invitationals before. Been to Amsterdam and done, it used to be Zapatero and it's Fight IQ. I did sub 15, was the first like sub only invitational thing I've done. I've done Tough Invitational. That was like one of the oldest school, like UK based ones. It was definitely the highest caliber one I've done. It's like one of those things, if you get a message to fight in Polaris, you don't even ask who, you just tell them like when, where, what weight. And
just walking around the changing rooms in awe of all these fighters, right?
Yeah, it was kind of surreal for me to fight on Polaris, because before that I'd been a fan and watched it. The first one was in Cardiff, and then I'd been in London and watched it, and then I'd helped Mike Leng. He'd done the marketing, so I helped him with the social media on One Polaris. I'd helped corner Fionn when she fought the title eliminator against Chelsea Lee. So I'd kind of been everywhere in there. I'd been corner, fan, like staff kind of. And then when they were like, do you want to compete on it? I was like, oh yeah, okay. Like, I think I've done everything there apart from ref. So,
well, one last box to tick then.
Yeah, no, I need to hit like Matt and Gareth up and see what they can sort out there.
So after that then, and most recently you fought on Grapple Fest, and obviously it didn't go your way, but how was that? Was one of the most exciting fights on that show?
Yeah, I think that it was an exciting match. I think my style would always bring an exciting match regardless of who the opponent is. But for me, that was probably psychologically was one of the worst I'd felt. And it's like, it's not to take it away from Dom. I don't want to be like, I'm saying like, oh yeah, it's just because my head wasn't in the game. It's like, I should have sorted my head out and been there. But it was like, Dom's very good and he's like an accomplished grappler. So it's like he won fair and square. But it was a good experience. But for me, it was like one of those ones where I hadn't mentally prepared for that kind of environment as well as I had for the British. It was kind of weird that I'd gone like 2 weeks previously, fought in the British, felt the best I'd ever felt, and fought like a European champion in the final and won, to then going on a show and feeling super terrible and being super, super nervous, not eating all day, just being that nervous, and then going and competing. But all in all, like, it was a good match. Like, it was exciting. And I think like me and Dom could fight again and it could go a completely different direction.
So yeah, it's like, hopefully they put it together again. It'd yeah, be so good
it's
to
like,
watch.
But like Chris Thompson's really good. He puts on like good matches. I think like you have some show like sub only shows. You have like Kasai and Polaris and stuff, and they put on good matches. But I think for like the sort of having their finger on the pulse, I think Chris does a really good job with Grapple Fest of like making styles merge for good matches. So he's very good at like he knows the sub only guys in the UK that he can like match up together, rather than just being like, oh, here's like one name and we'll put him against another like another big name or something. He like thinks about styles. So he like with you, when he put Lachlan against Ross, like that was like to the wire, and it's like because he'd matched the styles so well together to get an exciting match. Like you never see like a mismatch on there. So like it was a really good show. So yeah, I think like all in all, good experience, good show. But for me, it was kind of like my end probably wasn't what I'd want from it. So,
but it's not, you have some competitors out there who don't really admit that, don't really talk about, they talk about the wins, they talk about sort of how good they feel, but you find that some competitors don't actually show that other side and don't really talk about, you know, kind of the balance, and that unless your name's Gordon Ryan, you're not winning every fight all day every day.
Yeah,
as much like, as you want to, obviously.
Yeah, it's like one of those things, like I take losses very, very bad. Like I'm so bad, so competitive. Like we could play a match of Tiddlywinks and I'd still be annoyed if I lost. So it's like I'm really bad at
Leobard, who's sitting in the back, is nodding vigorously.
Yeah, like I hate losing. It's like one of those things. But I don't think, like, if you're an active competitor, like if you admit that you like losing, then you're probably lying.
You probably shouldn't be competing.
Yeah, nobody likes losing. So I take losses very, very bad. So it's like after I lost on Grapple Fest, I kind of was just like on social media, was like, "Yep, yeah, wasn't me. Sorry." Like fair play Dom, but it's like, it's part of the process. And for me, like I saw a saying the other day, and it like kind of like hit home, and it was like, never let a big win go to your head and don't let a big loss go to your heart. And it's kind of, you just have to do it. And I think too many people are too highlight reel happy and want to just focus on like that's all social media is. It's just a highlight reel of everyone's life, and too many people won't post it. And it's like, sometimes it's like, shit happens. Just like, accept it. It's like gonna, like nothing's gonna go your way. Like you look at Craig, like he did so well in ADCC, like yeah. tapped like Leandro Murillo, and he goes and like gets beat by Keenan, and then he comes back and he beats Keenan again. Or like, it's like, you're gonna doing so well, and he's like supposed to go and win Kasai when he fought Kynan, and then Kynan comes in, just like takes his back, chokes him. It's like, who cares? You're gonna win some, you're gonna lose some. Just
yeah. there's always the next fight.
Yeah, yeah. So
bit of a light topic now. Coffee and food. If anyone who follows you on social media, and if you don't already, I would recommend you do. You love your coffee.
I do.
And I was getting the rundown of just how much coffee you drink every day. And you also have under-caffeinated or over-caffeinated tattoos on you?
Over-caffeinated and under-prepared. So.
And has that helped your jiu-jitsu? Do you need your coffee to get through the jiu-jitsu day?
It's more that, like, I probably do have, like, a mild addiction to coffee, but it's one of the things, like, I've always had a passion for it, and I would, like, much rather have nice coffee than, like, just terrible coffee. Like, I definitely would say it helps me get through the day, but I think it's, like, kind of hand-in-hand with jiu-jitsu. It's like, you look at some jiu-jitsu people, and, like, a lot of jiu-jitsu people are into coffee as well. But I lived with a barista for a bit, and he was very, very into his coffee, so kind of passed on to that. Yeah, he had like a 12 grand like coffee machine set up in the living room, so I could wake up every morning and just go down and make a cup of coffee.
Some people got it just too nice, haven't they?
Yeah, but yeah, no, coffee's like a big part of my life, and that's where the over caffeinated and underprepared sort of tattoo came from. There's my circle of friends in uni, we were all into coffee, and there's like a saying we used to say, and like we'd walk into like assignments and exams and stuff, like doing our dissertation, and it was like, we're just over caffeinated and underprepared. And it's kind of one of those things, it was like saying for life, where it's like, doesn't matter, just drink a coffee and get it done. Like, doesn't matter if you feel prepared for it or not, just have a coffee and get it done.
I think many people should take that phrase on, right?
Yeah, definitely. Just shut up, have a coffee, get the job done.
So you talked about Craig Jones a bit and Keenan. Who are your heroes? Who do you, in jiu-jitsu or MMA or outside of that, you've talked about Mike. Do you look up to sort of draw knowledge from or just get inspired from?
Probably go into like a few heroes from like different aspects. Jiu-jitsu, like definitely Lucas Lepre, just such a fanboy. I think he'd be the only person that I'd be like scared to go up and ask for like a picture or something. Just like such a fanboy of Lucas Lepre. But that's just because it's his style and his approach, like his saying like be precise is something I try and like emulate now, and like I'm always like banging on to like the guys I teach, is like just be precise, like with what you're doing, just don't half-ass it, be precise and just crack on with it. So I think Lucas Lepre's massively just because of his game, and like he went away for a bit, like he'd won the worlds, he went away for a few years and didn't win it. You'd always like you fight like Leandro Lowe and stuff, and he'd like would like was always falling short, and then he's come back and he's like 6-time world champion now. So it's like kind of just that not quitting is something I really, really find inspirational from him. But he's more gi orientated, so he's like kind of like my gi hero. No gi, then it's like kind of like old school, like Marcelo, like the old MG in action is like one of the first like sort of instructions I watched, and Ryan Hall, and then Ryan Hall in MMA as well. He's sort of like just he's like doing it. He's like flying the flag for jiu-jitsu in MMA. So he's a big hero for me in MMA. And then GSP, he's the GOAT in MMA. He's just like so inspirational. And I just like, he was one of the ones as well that I would follow, and his approach to training, where he's like very sports science orientated. He wants to know more. He wants to know how can you get those 1%. And it's like a lot of people are like, that's only 1% better. But when you've got like 10 different avenues that are getting you 1%, and you're suddenly you're 10% better. And if that 10% better is going to be the difference between like being a world champion and not, then it's worth taking it.
Is that kind of when you look for people to look up to or sort of learning styles, do you like to look for clinical kind of science-based approaches?
Not necessarily. I think for me it's more what are their principles and do they stick to those principles like over time, or mm-hmm. if they do change their principles, like if they got valid reasons for it. So it's like there's a book by Ray Dalio called Principles, and there's something like it's a book that helped me a lot, and they say that in there is like, or he says that in there is if you have your principles and you stick to them, then you're succeeding already. And it's like, you look at GSP, his principles were sort of like he wanted to get that 1% better. He always was striving to be the little bit better, and he stuck to his guns with that. So I think it's more what someone's principles are. So like you look at Lucas Lepre, you could say the principle of being precise. He's always going to try and be precise with that, and he sticks with that. So he's like, he's never half-assing a technique. He's always like got that precision with what he's doing. And that's something I try and look for is like, what's the principles? Because you can teach the man the principles, or you can choose his methods. So it's that kind of approach is something I draw massively on. Outside of sport, then I think heroes I kind of look up to, or like inspiration I draw from, is like kind of like quite philosophical. Like I quite like that, the old cliche, like the Daily Stoic. I'm a big fan of sort of Marcus Aurelius, and Ralph Waldo Emerson is a big one. So just like try and like draw on these sort of essays and out the box thinkers is something I quite like, and their approach to thinking, I guess, rather than their approach to what they do, is just how they think about a situation is something I really sort of try and look for.
I guess if you have, you don't need to take particular approaches if you have the thinking. You can just use the approaches for everything, right?
Yeah, the principles. It's
like, yeah. And back to the principles. Yeah,
you have the principles in place, you can choose your methods. And that's something that Mike, like you just mentioned Mike, about him helping me with nutrition, is kind of like we're all like principle-based, and then the methods differ. So it's like the principle of a calorie deficit is the same regardless of your keto, vegan, like if it fits your macros, intermittent fasting, it's the principle of a calorie deficit, and then you base it off that, and it all fits in like that.
How much do you push that to the people you work with? The idea is just essentially calorie deficit is
a lot. Like I don't want it to be like all calorie deficit, because there's like things can change, and it depends what you're doing. Like obviously an MMA weight cut is a calorie deficit up to a certain point, and then when it's time to water cut, then it's a different approach. But I always try and tell like my clients that I want it to get to a point where you don't need me. Like it's as much like education for you as it is for you to get towards your goals. So it's kind of like teaching them the principles so they can then go away and choose their methods then. So it's like,
that's the difference between two different kind of coaches out there. You've got the Instagram ones who want to keep you coming and kind of
It's like pull you in. Like making money from it is fantastic, and like, there's no secret behind it. Like if someone wants to know something, I'll tell them whether they're a client of mine or not. But it's kind of like the art, the sort of intricacies come when it's time to tweak. You're like, yes, there's a calorie deficit, but what do you do once you've been a calorie deficit so long and your weight loss starts to plateau? And it's like understanding what variables to tweak then, and that's where sort of my skill set comes in. And understanding that a bit better than the average person, but you can sort of understand that eventually. It's just understanding it and learning it yourself a bit more.
You got to pick up a book.
Yeah, exactly. Just go and read a bit more and understand it. It's like wealth of knowledge at your fingertips nowadays with the internet and iPhones and everything.
So something I want to ask before we start coming to an end. What is kind of the hardest things you've had to learn in BJJ, and then the hardest thing you've had to learn outside of BJJ as well?
I think one of the hardest things in BJJ is understanding, I guess, how to effectively like understand the gray. It's probably like we mentioned it earlier. It's like understanding the gray, but it's like, I guess trying to understand what that gray is. Am I just trying to like philosophize like a position that's like doesn't need to be done like that, or whether I can actually just like sort of figure it out separately, and just understanding the little intricacies like and being able to ask good questions within that. So like when I'm like, as mentioned, those game of interest is like, am I just gonna ask a stupid question, or can I go and approach like Brendan O'Mead and we can sit down and be like, okay, I've been thinking about this and thinking this could come from it, what do you think about X, Y, and Z? And it's like, whether like you're an absolute idiot. And it's like understanding when's appropriate to ask a good question, understanding that the little fights, like the sort of I think John Danaher sort of articulates the best, is like, in that specific scenario and situation, what's the central problem? And like finding the central problem is probably one of the most difficult things, and that's something I've tried to nail down over the past couple of years, is in that scenario, what is the central problem? And then with that central problem, what are the answers to it, and where does that lead?
And that solves the other things that people worry about.
Yeah, yeah, like the kind of, you always get it, especially when you like instruct, you get those like few people that'll just be like, oh, what if they take this grip? What if they do that? And it's kind of like, no, like what's the main problem? How do you have an answer to that main problem? And the rest is kind of irrelevant then. Outside of jiu-jitsu, the hardest thing I've probably had to learn is probably saying no. It's actually like not taking on too much, mm-hmm. and learning to switch off is like forever just trying to do more, like take on
more projects.
Yeah, it's not just taking more projects, but then like trying to make the projects I've got as best I can. So I'm always busy, but I always somehow find time to binge watch a season of Netflix or something. So, but always like saying no and switching off is probably the hardest thing.
What is your downtime?
Probably watching Netflix. Go to the cinema. Big film nerd. So
we're just before the podcast started, we're just discussing your fresh tattoo.
Yeah, the Iron Man on my arm. So massive Marvel nerd. So I guess like going to the cinema is probably like my downtime. It's kind of can go there, don't have to talk to anyone, and just eat and shovel popcorn into my face and watch a film. So yeah, I guess like watching films is probably my biggest downtime, and maybe a bit of gaming. So
there is something about jiu-jitsu athletes and their correlation with nerds.
Yeah it just attracts nerds, and I think it's quite cool that you could like walk down the street and someone could be a massive nerd and they could be an absolute savage on the mats.
Yeah, it's the typical Miao brothers thing. It's like they look harmless.
Yeah, and I think like as well, like watching Jeremy Skinner on like Polaris when he fought Frank Rosenthal on Grabfest, and like you see him and he looks like such a dork, but he'd rip your leg off. So it's like, I think like yeah, there's a big correlation between nerds and jiu-jitsu. But I think it's just that problem solving. I think that's what attracts people, is like that sort of like the want to understand the problems, and that actually being strong and physical, if you're an absolute dumbass, doesn't get you very far.
Yeah, the kind of jock mentality only takes you so far.
Yeah, like maybe if you get like a blue or purple belt, but after that, it's like, it's a slow progress from there.
Okay, so I put a Q&A on Instagram. Yeah. I have one that says, can you ask him where he gets all his positivity quotes from, and if he doesn't mention my name, I'll be upset.
Is this Greg Creel?
It is Greg Creel.
Yeah. He messaged me and he was like, I've asked the question, it's a sensible one, because normally Greg sends me questions and they're absolutely stupid ones. Positivity ones is actually from, I have a Chrome extension called Momentum or Moment, and it just posts up like a picture. When you open up a new tab, it's got a picture of like a really nice scenic like scene somewhere, like somewhere far away, somewhere exotic, and then I have like a quote on the bottom, like every day there's a new quote, so that's usually it, either that or the Daily Stoic on Instagram. So yeah, shout out to Greg, my favorite hippo. I think he's my long lost brother as well.
Does he look like a hippo?
He's probably the most athletic big guy I've ever met. If you get a chance to roll with Greg Creel, you'll roll there and you're like, how is someone so big and moving like that? He is like a hippo floating through the water. He's very graceful for a big guy.
To be fair, his other question was, do you look like, ask him why he looks like smashed avocado. I think you've already explained the spud jitsu part, so yeah. I'll leave that.
yeah, I haven't got a very aesthetically pleasing face. So.
Just to close off, we're going to be asking every person this. The first thing is, if you had to give one piece of advice to, you know, your white belts, your blue belts, or amateur MMA fighters, people who are kind of working their way up, and something that you may have experienced too, what kind of advice would you give them for their journey?
Take care of your body, 100%. Like, as a blue belt, I would just try and murder myself. It was like, if I wasn't murdered after a session, whether that's in the gym, like weights or on the jiu-jitsu mats, I was like, I wasn't happy. And it's actually like, to win the game, you've got to stay in the game. So you have to, it's something I've tried to take care of now, is like actually recovery and rehab, and like enough sleep, adequate calories and stretching, like doing the old yoga for BJJ and stuff. Actually taking care of your body is something that is probably the biggest one. It's like, it's all well and good being a hero for 5 minutes, but it's like the people that are consistently there are going to be the people that sort of succeed in the long run. So it's actually just taking care of yourself.
There you go, blue belts. You've been told, don't smash the weights and give yourself a hernia.
Yeah, I think there was more though that like, I probably wouldn't think like that if I hadn't gone through like doing that and being like that naive and just being like, I can just bounce back from this and do like a billion rounds a day. So I think taking care of yourself is probably the biggest one. But I think sometimes you have to go through that to understand it.
Yeah. And the other thing was, if you have one thing to recommend for people to do, read, watch, is there something that you would recommend, something that you're watching now, or for example?
I think reading is definitely the biggest one for me. I'm a big fan of like audiobooks and stuff. So if I was going to recommend some books to people, is Principles by Ray Dalio is like just probably a game changer for me. And then it's not really jiu-jitsu related, but helped me with like academia and getting like sort of non-jiu-jitsu work done, is Deep Work by Cal Newport. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, when it's kind of how I approach it, and it's how I'm probably able to do as much as I do. And it's just like, when it's time to work, it's time to work. Just head down, crack on. And it's like understanding how to do that. It's kind of a skill that when it's time to work, you like flick a switch and work. So that Deep Work is a really, really good one. So it's read more. I think stay off social media, read more books.
Yeah, stop flicking through the IG, pick up a book.
Unless it's my Instagram.
Obviously. The final question, and especially as you're a superhero fan, if you had to build your perfect superhero, how would you build them? Would they have jiu-jitsu skills? Would they fly? What, build your perfect superhero?
As I'm a big Iron Man fan, I think it would have to be that they are intelligent enough to be able to build something that they could fly with. And then also, I think, just if Iron Man can do jiu-jitsu, I think if Iron Man and John Wick had a child, then that'd be pretty good.
I can't wait to see that film.
I think that's how John Wick's gonna go though. I think it's gonna be like, we're gonna have John Wick 8, like John Wick versus Predator or something.
I think, was it Samurai Swords on Motorcycles is the last one I saw.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Yeah, it's epic.
That's it. The dream is Keanu Reeves fighting Predator in an Iron Man suit.
Yeah.
I might have to name the podcast, the first episode, that. And call it Ben Robson, Keanu Reeves, and the Predator.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for being the first guest on the Prodigy podcast.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for trekking up to sunny Cardiff.
It's all right. I learned some great leg locks as well in your class. Do you want to promote your IG?
Yeah. So just follow at Spud Jitsu and then at @unorthodox_performance for the sort of S&C side of things. That's it really. Just, I guess, like thank the sponsors, Whiskey Wolf and Tatami, for keeping me on the mats. Yeah. And thank you for having me on, and thank you for coming up.
Great. Thank you very much, Ben.